duck, duck, goose!
In stereo. Hi, this is Dan Nexon, and in today's episode, I'll be talking to Ted Hopf. So, hi, Ted. Thanks for agreeing to be on the podcast today.
Nice to talk to you again, Dan.
So, I thought that we would start things off with a few biographical details. Maybe you could tell people who are listening a bit about yourself.
Well, I got my PhD from Columbia in political science and Soviet Studies at the Harriman Institute. I did a couple of years of a pre- and postdoc at the Olin Institute at Harvard when Sam Huntington was still running the shop. My first job was at Michigan, then went on to Ohio State, and now I'm moving to the National University of Singapore.
That's a big move. Are you excited about it?
It's thrilling. I can't wait.
What are
I
you
next week?
What are you going to be? Ooh, next week. What are you going to be doing there?
Well, besides, teaching the usual complement of IR theory and qualitative methods courses, there's a move to, I don't call it rebuild, but to build the department. There are a lot of resources available to build in IR, comparative, and political theory. And, of course, there's a lot of excitement about the Yale and U.S. Liberal Arts College, where NUS will be hiring up to 200 new professors in humanities and social sciences over the next 5 years to staff the teaching for that.
So can we consider that a call for American PhDs to apply for positions then?
Oh, yeah. My own department is full of American PhDs, in fact, in political science, American and European PhDs.
It actually seems like there's been an exodus of some, like you, some, you know, really kind of top-ranked, really good people in the field to Singapore over the last couple of years. Is that because of these kinds of opportunities and resources, or are there other factors at work, do you think?
Well, obviously the job market is tight, right, mm-hmm. in the U.S. I mean, when I think about the number of places I would like to go from Ohio State, the list is very short. I mean, Ohio State has a really, really good IR faculty and has a Michonne Center, and there's probably not 10 places in the world that I'd rather be, but Singapore is a growing place, has a lot of resources. I've never had a leadership role in building a department before, so building an institution really appeals to me, attracting graduate students in IR in particular there appeals to me. And plus, of course, I've never spent any time in Asia other than Siberia, so traveling around East Asia, Southeast Asia, India and so forth also appeals to me.
I want to follow up about, you've been to Siberia?
Well, of course. I did do the Soviet Union and Russia for a living.
Right, but I think it's rare to find American. Maya, who you know, my wife, travels to Siberia frequently for work, and it's rare to find Americans who've been to the Soviet Far East, let alone the wilds of Siberia, as it were, which I know aren't really that wild because there are large cities and stuff, but
I've seen the largest head of Lenin in the world in Ulan Ude. It's about 40 feet tall of a single block of pink granite. I've gone sable trapping in a Lake Baikal National Wildlife Refuge. I've been to a young Communist League meeting in Nahotka and foraged for food in the 1980s when there was no food to be had.
Wow. You should write a travelogue, I think.
The experience in the Hotka is something to immortalize. We were invited to a beachside picnic, and we brought some vodka and other drinks with us. But when we got there, we realized there was no food. And so we spent the time, this one guy tied baskets to his feet with vines and went diving for mollusks and gathered seaweed and sea berries and what have you, and that was our meal.
Well, the thing that I think, as I think about it, if you're going to Singapore, it means you will be in the same time zone as you were in when you were in Siberia.
That's true, but I think 60 degrees south.
Yeah, it's amazing, though. I think people just don't realize how big now the Russian Federation, once the Soviet Union actually is, you know, that it has, what, 12 time zones in it? Something.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're trying to reduce them now.
Yeah, I thought that the rationalization of time was something that was sort of Medvedev's project, and now Putin was thinking about going back on that.
Yeah, a lot of things that Medvedev speculated about have been dropped.
So before we get into, I think, what I'm most interested in talking to you about, which is your work, your intellectual evolution, things you're doing now, I do have to note there's been some controversy about the American partnerships with Singapore, and there have been some rather scathing newspaper articles and stuff, or op-eds recently, mostly focused on questions about restrictions on freedom of speech or other autocratic elements of Singapore. Have you had a chance to think about any of that at all, or weigh that?
Certainly no. It's quite ironic. I mean, as you know from Facebook, when I was mulling over the choice between LSU and Singapore, I asked my Facebook friends to give me advice, and the score was about 32-2 in favor of going to Singapore. And the ironic thing was is that given the fact that many of my friends on Facebook are political scientists and IR people, not a single person raised the issue of Singapore's authoritarianism. And I think maybe even in a conversation with you or someone else, you noted, well, I probably thought you'd already internalized that cost, right? I mean, obviously, I would have considered that. And it certainly was a consideration, but, you know, since I have, you know, plenty of interesting colleagues there, like Terry Narden and Janice Gelly-Mottram, Ian Chong, Ruben Wan, and so forth, obviously, every discussion I had when I was interviewing there, you know, raised the issue of academic freedom. And, it, you know, it clearly is, it's a restricted society politically, and indeed on my work permit papers to get in, I had to pledge not to participate in politics, not to participate in demonstrations against the government and so forth. But then again, you know, I have very little intention of doing those things, and my research interests don't revolve around Singapore and domestic politics. And the university itself, I mean, you can publish and lecture and assign any readings you want and have any discussions you want. I mean, it's not as long as you're in the Soviet Union and you have to worry about what you say in class. So I'm reassured on that point. I mean, there are a bunch of courses on democratization and so forth on the syllabus that are taught regularly. I'm sure Singapore is not held out as an example of it. And I did receive a unsolicited email from a Yale alumnus on my faculty at LSU warning me against going to NUS and participating in the the reproduction of the authoritarian regime. But I chose to go anyway.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a terrific experience, and I hope everything works out well. I know that you're, as you said earlier, it's a very exciting proposition to be able to build a program, particularly one that has both undergraduate and PhD level components. And I do know, referencing the mass exodus, that there are really a terrific group of scholars out there doing a whole variety of work. So I thought that in terms of how to get us started on your work, your scholarship, one of the interesting things about your career is that you've been through some pretty significant intellectual evolutions. I mean, many of us kind of figure out how we approach scholarship in grad school, and we don't ever change. But that's certainly not the case with you. So I thought maybe you could start us off by telling us a bit about your intellectual journey.
Well, I surely haven't been strategic, that's for sure. I'll talk a little bit about what the costs of that have been. I mean, I probably prematurely changed my mind about scholarship. Most people do it after they get tenure. I did mine before I got tenure and paid the price. But it's funny because we have a tendency to impose a false coherence on our intellectual evolution. But I think I have, because I did change, I've kind of had an opportunity to think back, and hopefully this won't appear too coherent, but I can start with the beginning, which was, growing up during the Vietnam War and watching, body counts on the Huntley Brinkley Report every night, and they were more or less like this, that, 875 BC NVA were killed, 123 Arvin were killed, and, 23 Americans were killed that day. And it happened day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. And even as a kid, a 12, 13-year-old, I begin to ask myself, why haven't we won this war? I mean, if these are the body counts, it doesn't make much sense. And what happened was the Pentagon Papers came out when I was of that age, and I read the New York Times abridged version of them. And even as a kid, I read this, read this book, and it occurred to me that there was nothing about Vietnam in the book, that there were no stakes in Vietnam. We weren't fighting for Vietnam. We were fighting for teaching lessons to the Soviet Union. So I became interested in the Soviet Union then as a kid. And when I went off to college, I became a Russian studies major. And I went off to grad school at Columbia. Of course, they had the Harriman Institute. But what I didn't know until I got to grad school that there was a theory out there to explain all this, and it was deterrence theory. It was Thomas Schelling and Glenn Snyder and others who helped explain why you fight for reputation in unimportant areas of the world. And so my dissertation became Soviet Lessons from Victories and Defeats in the Periphery, called Peripheral Visions, in which I tested this assumption of deterrence theory and came away satisfied to myself that, in fact, the Vietnam War was a completely pointless waste of blood and treasure, including 2 million dead Vietnamese, for the sake of reputation, because the Soviets didn't infer the kinds of lessons from American defeats in the periphery that deterrence theorists like Schelling assumed and then American policymakers assumed who applied the deterrence model. So that was my first kind of wave of research. And, of course, since I was working with Bob Jervis, my first book has psychological models to help explain why you get the kind of decision making you do. So you have motivated belief systems and rational attribution theory and this kind of rational model that are tested in the book. So you could say that my first wave, if you will, is kind of like a subjectivist ontology where I was taken with how decision makers perceive the world. And then, again, this is completely incoherent, but I had a grad seminar with John Ruggie where I had to write a paper. And the paper I came up with was to look at another historical case of polarity to test Ken Waltz's notions of neorealism, namely that bipolar systems produce stability and multipolar systems don't. But I went back to the period from 1495 to 1559 to look at the Habsburg-Belval rivalry, which is how most European histories treat that period, and that would be the bipolar moment. But in fact, once you do all the calculations on the material distribution of power in that period, it turns out it's not the Habsburgs against the Belval, but rather the Habsburgs against the Ottoman Empire. And at any rate, it turns out the polarities didn't matter. In that case as well, there were subjective perceptions involved as well in terms of bandwagoning the offense-defense balance, and the offense-defense balance, both objectively military, the objective military balance between offense and defense, plus subjective beliefs about bandwagoning and dominoes and so forth help account for the relatively stable level of instability across the two periods. So the change in polarity didn't make any difference. So that's where I was when I got to Michigan. I had this book manuscript, which became Peripheral Visions, and I had this APSR article. Actually, it's a good story about the APSR article because I was rejected by World Politics. But we could have a whole website of rejection letters, of course, but one particular reviewer's comment stand out where he or she wrote, "Although I know very little about the history of this period, I'm sure the author has the history wrong." So I sent it off to APSR, and APSR took it, which is probably good for me. But at any rate, so when I got to Michigan, I was more or less a qualitative kind of decision-making guy. But while I was there, I guess a critical moment there was that they had something called the Colloquium for the Study of Social Transformation, which was an interdisciplinary group of historians, anthropologists, sociologists, a couple political theorists, myself, and I guess that's about it. And this is the group of Ron Suni and Terry McDonald, Jeff Ely, Nick Dirks was in it, Amory Stoller, Peggy Summers, and they're bringing people from Chicago and so forth as well. And so I was exposed to a whole bunch of social theory, which I'd never read in grad school. And this was kind of set there, because I continued, you know, kind of working on stuff to do with the Soviet Union, Soviet foreign policy, and so forth. But sometime in, I guess it was 1996 or 97, maybe even a little bit earlier, I received a phone call from the Grand Rapids World Affairs Council. I tell this story just to show just how accidental one's research trajectory might be, but also as a forewarning, because, you know, my colleagues, probably my more orthodox colleagues in my department, party would have been much happier had I just written a medium N collection of case studies of polarities and published that as my second book. But what happened is I got this phone call asking me to come give a talk at the Grand Rapids World Affairs Council on U.S. interests in Central Asia. And I said yes, even though I knew nothing about U.S. interests in Central Asia, but they figured that since I knew the Soviet Union, I must know about Central Asia. I thought for a second, well, you know, I don't think the U.S. has many interests in Central Asia, but perhaps it's just like the Cold War, and so U.S. interests will be derivative of Russian interests there. And I thought, well, what would Russian interests be in Central Asia? And I thought, well, they do have 5, 6, 7 million Russians living there, so that could be Russian interests. As we remember from the collapse of the Soviet Union, there's a lot of alarmist talk about the Russians trying to, you know, patriate or liberate Russians abroad, because there were 25 million of them at the collapse of the Soviet Union. But then I thought, well, why would Russians living in Uzbekistan, for example, ever think of themselves as Russians as opposed to Uzbek citizens? And then I kind of stopped, because I didn't have the kind of like the theoretical apparatus to think through that issue. And then happenstantially, invited to CSST and for a talk was Drew Gladney, an anthropologist from USC who works on the Uyghurs in Xinjiang and Kyrgyzstan. And he gave this talk about how when an Uyghur elder is walking down the street, with each interaction, he becomes a different identity, depending on with whom he interacts. And then the light bulb went off in my head. And I read the paper that Drew Gladney delivered, and a lot of it was inspired by Bourdieu. And so I went out and read Outline for a Theory of Practice, Outline for Logic of Practice, and Theory of Practice by Bourdieu, and I was off to the races. And that's how I became a constructivist.
And so was the work that produced, that culminated in the Russian foreign policy, Soviet foreign policy book?
The Social Construction of International Politics book. Because it's a very strange trajectory, right? Because I didn't, you know, I really had paid very, very, very little attention to constructivism in the 1990s when it was taking off with Alex Wendt and others from 1989 on. And so I'm off kind of like hewing my own path on identity and foreign policy. And only later, as I'm working on the book came out in 2002, I started working on it in, I guess, 95, 96, after this talk that I gave, only later did I realize that, well, there's this whole stream of IR that's growing, constructivist IR and identity. And I really only, you know, I didn't start out writing the book as a contribution to constructivist IR theory, but I more or less had to, because there was a conversation to be had between how I conceptualize identity and social construction and foreign policy and IR theory. So essentially the book goes on as if that conversation isn't occurring until we get to the concluding chapter, when I go back and compare my results and my methods and my theory to the mainstream constructivist IR accounts of identity and foreign policy, identity and IR.
So I think that it might be worthwhile to tell our listeners, some of whom may not be familiar with the book, a little bit more about its methodology, because I think that one of the big splashes it made in the field was the way in which it used techniques that are commonly associated with I don't want to say ethnography, although it's heavily ethnographic, but more than just kind of participant observation kinds of microethnography studies. I mean, it was in a sense one of the first kind of macroethnographic studies, I think, in the field.
Right, because it's very strange in the sense. Again, you have to keep stressing this CSST group at Michigan, because by the time I'm getting to work on this, Michigan had more or less purged itself of all qualitative political scientists. When I came to Michigan in 1990, they were making a big push to break out of the Midwest mold. They had hired Matt Evangelista, Charlie Glazer, Ed Gibson came, Jeff Winters came, Pradeep Chipper came, although he's semi-quantitative. And they had postdocs, Heim Kaufman, Bob Pape, Carl Mueller. By the time I started work on this project, 95, 96, every single one of those scholars had left. Either they had been pushed out by, you know, writing on the wall that you're not going to get tenure here, or they had left on their own accord, feeling, you know, increasingly uncomfortable about the coming turn. So I was like the only person left. And so my intellectual community was hardly political science. It was Fred Cooper and Jane Burbank. It was Michael Kennedy in sociology. It was Peggy Summers in sociology. It was Neil Fargole in sociology. Ann Stoller in sociology, Ron Suni in history, Jeff Ely in history. That was my intellectual community, and we read a lot of, you know, social identity, social theory kind of stuff. And all those people, of course, are doing ethnographies at a minimum. Well, it's very, very hard to do an ethnography in IR because, especially if you're doing historical IR, my cases were 55 and 99. And if you're going to do an ethnography of identity and foreign policy, you literally have to be within a foreign policy-making institution, like Ivar Neumann's work has done in the Norwegian foreign ministry. But I didn't have that prospect in the Russian case. So the second best approach was doing discourse analysis, try to recover the intersubjective worlds that predominated in the Soviet Union in 1955 and Russia in 1999 through text. But it really is a second best approach. So yeah, there's this methodological, maybe uniqueness at the time, but there was also a theoretical commitment that also made it unusual. And that is the expectation that domestic identity construction matters as much, if not more, for interactions among states as identity construction between states. Because if you recall the history of constructivist IR theory, it had its own significant other, and the significant other was neorealism. So when Alex Wendt wrote his work, culminating in Social Theory of IR in 99, his significant other was Ken Waltz's structural realism. And so consequently, he wanted to write a systemic constructivism, so all the action takes place between states, and he brackets the domestic, just like Waltz brackets the domestic. To Wendt's credit, of course, he constantly repeatedly points out that he's not claiming that the domestic doesn't matter. It's simply not what he's theorizing. So I was theorizing what he bracketed. So I'm trying to recover in my work, in that book, in the 2002 book, I'm trying to recover as much mass discourse in text as possible, novels, movies, and so forth, in order to reconstruct the identity topography that I hypothesize informs how Soviet elites then understand themselves when relating to others in international politics. Then I guess the third, contribution of that book is that it actually has a dependent variable that gets tested in the sense that in the 55 case, at least, I could go to the archives, which I did for several years, and actually look at the secret deliberations among Soviet foreign policy elites about Yugoslavia, about Eastern Europe, about the United States, about China, about the Third World, and so forth, and see whether or not these mass understandings of what it meant to be Soviet actually inform how these Soviet elites understand the Soviet Union in respect to these other countries. And for the most part, the hypothesis bore itself out.
I think it's important to stress each aspect of their contribution, but I don't want us to gloss over the importance of the way that you engaged in a very intense, labor-intensive discourse analytic approach to figuring out understandings of Soviet and Russian identity. Because I think that one of the things that people may not, you know, younger scholars may not recognize is that if you go back to a lot of the identity work that was being done in the 1990s, and I know this is a fairly broad brush from which to mix my metaphors to tar what was happening. But a lot of people would sort of say, okay, we're going to posit that state identity drives foreign policy. And then the descriptive, the empirical content of that state identity claim was often pretty thin, right? It was, you know, based on kind of secondary source macro statements about how, well, you know, German identity is specific. And Peter's work obviously doesn't fall into this trap, so I don't want it to sound like I'm talking about his work, but, you know, German or Japanese or Chinese identity is like X. Here are some historians or some commentators who say it's like X, and I know the case pretty well, so that's what I think. Ergo, that explains their behavior Y. And what you were doing was moving beyond not just that level of superficiality, but also you were moving beyond elite sources. You were looking, as you said, at film, novels, at the entire kind of cultural milieu. And that, I think, was really pretty radical, even within constructivism at the time. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. But obviously I wouldn't have done it unless I thought it was the right thing to do methodologically and theoretically, especially theoretically. My view of social constructivism is that, you know, it's constructivism all the way down. You can't pretend as if foreign policy elites are hermetically sealed from their societies. Moreover, there's a certain, there's a certain methodological principle at stake here as well, in the sense that if you stop with decision-making elites as a social constructivist, what you're really arguing then is that each individual is uniquely constructed, which is completely contrary to 125 years of social theory about how identities are constructed. If people are being socialized, let's go back to Berger and Luckman, 66, if elites are being socialized within a society, one should expect that much of that socialization is going to appear in their adult lives. So that should be the working hypothesis, not the reverse, that each individual can look with their own identity for the country. Second, of course, is you get a lot of bang for the buck. I mean, if you can reconstruct the identity topography, the predominant discourses of national identity in a society, then you can expect that that's going to be pretty predoring, and that you'll be able to explain outcomes across regimes, across decision makers. Right. So, like, to speed ahead, in the book that I just published this year.
Excellent, because I was about to ask you about that. So,
well, this is perfect. Let me just mention it and we'll come back to it. But in reconstructing the Cold War, I do from 45 to 58. And so, of course, there's a huge regime change in 53 with Stalin's death. And yet I'm able to show the continuities across, but I'm also to show that the changes that occur under Khrushchev are already present under Stalin within a discourse of Soviet national identity that's counter-hegemonic, that's being repressed. So I'm able to demonstrate empirically that, in fact, you know, Khrushchev didn't come to power with all sorts of new ideas in his personal head, but rather mass society already had a collection of ideas that first Beria and then Malenkov and then Khrushchev adopted as the prevailing Soviet identity project. So that's very important because, as you noted, a lot of work goes into reconstructing this identity topography. And again, I agree with you that, you know, Thomas Berger, Peter Kassenstein, and Rodney Bruce Hall are probably the three scholars that have done the most with mass understandings of national identity as opposed to just elite understandings. So it's a lot of work up front, but it promises a far more powerful explanation for a much longer period of time and far more kind of theoretically consistent with the principles of social constructivism and this idea that elites are somehow constructing national identity all by themselves without society. Or, you know, as Alex might put it, he wrote that states always have their societies in tow, unquote. And I'm looking at the societies in tow.
So what's one of the other things that's interesting about the evolution of your work, not so much in terms of the way that we could reconstruct something like a coherent biography, and I appreciate that they're very active explaining what you were, you know, how you got to be where you are today imposes a degree of coherence upon it that, you know, probably isn't at all accurate. But, and I think that's true for all of us, right? I'm not claiming that you're uniquely incoherent. We're talking about the post-hoc reconstruction itself,
can I
right?
Can I stop there for a second? Because, you know, there is a professional premium put on coherence.
Yeah, isn't it? It's bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, again, when I think back to my own career, I mean, I could have been successful at Michigan had I reproduced my Polarity work, right, and become like a Polarity scholar. There's a high premium on like, hulling the same row. Right, as opposed to being as seen by the field, being blown off course. Well, I never felt like I was being blown off course. I mean, I was quite naive and maybe even stupid at Michigan by not realizing that there were costs to me just following my intellectual honesty. Really, I mean, I was just doing what I thought was intellectually defensible. I never thought about tenure. I never thought about my career. I just thought about, well, this is a way at getting at this question. And I went off and did it. But I think it's quite daunting for, junior scholars to think about, and when they're, you know, let's say they've got their first book under their belt and they're thinking of their second project, it's quite safe to try to think of an extension of that original project rather than jumping off into something else where not only will perhaps their own department not look so highly on you, but think about, like in my case, my problem was is that I wasn't a card-carrying constructivist, right, because I hadn't been at Minnesota or elsewhere where you have, like, a school of constructivism. In fact, I was still in the, you know, Jervis Snyder, Steve Waltz, Steve Van Evera, you know, camp, if you will. So when I came up for tenure, those people who were my, you know, basically my patrons when I was a graduate student, were worried, well, where in the world is he going? Whereas any constructivist writing for me for tenure would go, well, he's not one of us either, right? So I didn't even think through that problem. And, you know, maybe I should have, from a careerist point of view. But as I always stress to my graduate students, there's always a tension between intellectual integrity, theoretical integrity and honesty, and careerism, that often for careerist reasons you have to choose to write about some things rather than others, choose some methods rather than others. But you should never, like, deceive yourself about what you're doing. I mean, we all make pragmatic choices in order to get published and get tenure and so forth. But we shouldn't deceive ourselves into thinking, I mean, we should realize that when we're making these kind of intellectual sacrifices, and hopefully once you get tenure, you can go back and do what you thought you should have done in the first place.
You know, I want to stress it's not just about a comfort zone issue, right? The ease of continuing to do what you're doing and expanding it out somewhat. And it's not just about kind of identifying your community of patrons and having that community of patrons continue to back you. But there also is just generally a kind of, at the two most important points in your scholarly career, that is when you're applying for jobs and then when you're up for tenure. All of the pressures about how you present the self are all about telling that kind of coherent story. I am the X person, and here is the community of discourse in which I operate. I think it is very hard to make a convincing pitch in either of those settings if you can't do that. I mean, I know that personally, when I was coming up for tenure, and I was trying to write my research statement, you know, my temptation was to say, well, you know, I kind of do a bunch of stuff and it's linked by what I'm interested in. But that clearly is not an acceptable way to tell a story about who you are for the purposes of being evaluated by the field. But you say that you tell your grad students, about this trade-off, but do you have any recommendations about how they balance that trade-off?
Well, certainly one has to be concerned with getting a job when you're a graduate student. So I constantly preach pragmatism and, you know, say things, you know, don't do what I'm doing, right? I teach a qualitative methods course, which is basically a course that looks at alternative epistemologies, discourse analysis, interpretivism, ethnography. And every week is spent talking about, here's the ideal research design. And obviously the ideal research design is not doable in a dissertation because you don't have the time or the resources. So what choices are you going to make? What sacrifices are you going to make? What shortcuts, pragmatic workarounds are you going to come up with in order to remain true to your theoretical priors, ontological priors if you have them, epistemological commitments if you have them, and yet still produce a credible piece of political science that the mainstream community will appreciate? And unfortunately, at least both at Michigan and at Ohio State, I've been blessed with a remarkable collection of graduate students who, by and large, get it and go off, and they produce very, very interesting social theoretically informed work that still has methodological chops, right? That still demonstrate that they understand they need to set up some kind of test, they need to gather their data in some kind of a defensible way, that they need to take into account alternative explanations for the outcome they're trying to explain. But they don't let that dominate what they're doing. But it sits there, and plus it allows them, no matter what audience they're addressing, it allows them to answer the kinds of methodological questions that come up, like how's your argument falsifiable? How'd you operationalize this? Why'd you conceptualize the variable this way rather than that way? What about this alternative explanation? I mean, they have to be forearmed. And the problem with a lot of social theory and IR that I see and read around the world, but especially, I have to confess, non-U.S. scholarship, they don't pay enough attention to that. And so when I assign a lot of readings from non-U.S. authors, and my students come away going, well, it was interesting, but, and they can launch into all sorts of critiques about that they never set it up in such a way as to distinguish this account from that account. The evidence they have is really thin, as you noted before, about the identity work in IR. So I guess my commitment is to produce work that satisfies mainstream criteria for methodological rigor while simultaneously providing the kind of thick description, kind of the Gerhardtian web of meaning, the recovery of the intersubjective world that would be convincing to an ethnographer and anthropologist reading it.
So when your second book appeared, as we talked about earlier, I think it was read by many as, kind of, here is an example of doing ethnographic research in the field that, as you alluded to before, makes theoretical claims that are consistent with consistent with mainstream understandings of how do we test and evaluate things. So a whole bunch of kind of ethnographic collection to identify the independent variable, but you're testing that against a dependent variable, and it made a huge splash for those reasons. And I remember, I don't think I did. I first meet you at the Institute for Qualitative Research Methods. I certainly saw you speak.
I don't know if I cure him.
I think it was at IQRM that I first saw you gave an extensive talk, and it was, you were brought in to present ethnographic work, but maybe my brain has turned to hash over the years, and that could be wrong. But I think that's a good marker, that you were brought in to IQRM to, be one of the ethnography guys or gals, and that was, really kind of the way that a lot of people received the book. But over the last few years, the book's been, I think, reinterpreted or reappropriated, because I think both of these are there, and they're not even necessarily distinctive within the book, as one of the foundational works of the practice turn, right? And you've had a lot of interesting things to say about the practice turn that come out of what sounds like a much longer engagement with Bourdieu back to your days in Michigan than I think those of us who sort of naively received the book as primarily just kind of small e-ethnography understood. So you've had some interesting things to say about that. And one of those things was a lecture you've been giving in a a piece you've been working on called the unbearable liberalness of the or unbearable liberalism of the practice turn. And I was hoping you might tell us a little bit about your assessment of the contemporary practice turn and how it's headed.
Well, it started out as the unbearable liberalism of constructivist IR theory. It's only been narrowed to the praxis term because of, again, another accidental thing. I was asked to review the Pulio Adler volume on International Practices, I believe it's called.
Yeah, something
Cambridge
like that.
Edited volume. Let me just put it this way. When I started reading Verdue and Berger and Lachman and Schutz and Adorno and Horkheimer and Foucault, of course, I came away thinking that the Frankfurt School and other social theorists for the last 125 years have had one central question, and that central question is, why has there been so little social change in the face of objective misery, inequality, conflict, oppression, repression, homophobia, ethnocentrism, racism, and so forth? And all of them, in one way or another, have come to the conclusion that the reason for this is intersubjective structures. Whether we're talking about life worlds, webs of meaning, imaginaries, collective conscience, and so forth, or habitus, doxa, you name it, episteme, discursive formations. It's all about individuals who have agency, who have the capacity to think differently and act differently, not doing so. And again, because constructivism, social constructivism, was born in opposition to near realism, and because Alex Wendt wrote a book that was the anti-theory of international politics, and obviously deliberately chosen title, Social Theory of International Politics, instead of Theory of International Politics, the constructivism got directed at explaining change in international relations, because the central critique of neorealism was that it could not explain change, is that its structure was not generative. But with Alex's use of needs, social needs, symbolic interactionism, married up with Giddens structurationism, he claimed to be able to account for at least two changes from the Hobbesian to the Lockean world, from the Lockean to an emergent Kantian world, and hence constructivism came to understand itself as a theory of change. So you end up with a slew of articles and books about changes in norms of, norms of citizenship, norms of military intervention, norms of sovereignty, so forth and so on. But I don't think that any of these IR scholars really believe that Verdue and Foucault and so forth are theorists of change. But the empirical work or the applied work that they have written has all been directed against neorealism's static theory, and so come away with the impression that constructivism is about change. And again, because I wasn't educated as a constructivist, but I'm kind of like an autodidact and came to social theory through that colloquium at Michigan through my own readings, I never thought of constructivism as a theory of change. I certainly knew that it provided for the potential for change more than structural realism did, but I also realized that these theorists, these social theorists on which we rest our current IR theories, were incredibly pessimistic about change. And hence, I always had in the back of my head that the charges made by Mearsheimer in his famous IS article, where he claims that constructivists think that all people have to do is think differently and the world will be different. At the time, I thought he was 100% wrong and he had misread constructivist theory. Now, 10, 15 years later, I think, John Mearsheimer was right, because he hadn't read the social theory. He'd only read the constructivist theory, and the constructivist theory is all about change. And that he was wrong, right, But he was only wrong in the sense that he'd been misled by the constructivist IR out there. And so this kind of this thing has been gnawing at me for 10 years or more, 15 years, about how constructivism has been kind of misappropriated. And there's not enough emphasis on how hard change is in these different social theories. That when the practice turn came around, when Pulio wrote, Vincent Pulio and I have known each other for years before his practice turn article in I.O. And so we've had conversations mostly about methodology because of his subjectivism piece. But when that came out, I was simultaneously working on my Logic of Habit piece, which came out a couple of years later in the EJIR. And it's as if we're not reading the same theorists. And then when I got the Adler and Pulio volume, it even became more striking to me that even reading the same theorists, there seems to be a commitment, a normative commitment to change that then colors how one goes about interpreting these theorists. Now, I don't want to be too harsh, because I understand that the practice turn is very, very early. And at ISA in San Diego this year, I guess in April, I had the opportunity to be on a panel on the practice turn where I trotted out, first draft of my arguments about its unbearable liberalism, and both Emmanuel and Vincent were in the audiences. We had a good discussion, and I think that there's probably, I'm sure, when all the dust settles, it'll turn out that we're a lot closer than we think. But right now, we appear to be at completely opposite ends of the spectrum on this issue. So, I've gone back to Bourdieu and I've gone back to John Dewey, because John Dewey is also a theorist upon which the practice turn rests. And I found John Dewey is equally pessimistic. I mean, equally pessimistic about change in the social order.
So this is not a pragmatist versus continental practice turn split. You think that it's embedded in all of those trajectories?
Yeah, well, I think that I mean, Gunther Hellman's work relies on Dewey, and other European IR scholars rely on Dewey. And I think they, again, I mean, I don't want, this is going to sound really, it's too harsh, but let's put it this way. It appears as this is like a systematically biased reading of these theorists to find everything about change in them that can possibly promote a practice turn that accounts for both change and stasis. I have a list, and you've kindly posted my lecture at University of Minnesota on Luck of Minerva, and I have a list of sources of change in both Bourdieu and Dewey. So they do have sources of change, but it doesn't entail the kind of non-reflective micro-behaviors that unintentionally alter the intersubjective world to produce change. I mean, Dewey talks about taking over institutions. Dewey writes of systematically changing the American education system to teach people to develop habits of not having habits. And of course, Bourdieu talks about the need for crises, depressions, wars, economic conflict, and so forth in order to produce change. Now, that's a whole list of exogenous shocks to the system, plus basically power politics, taking over institutions and inculcating a climate, an institutionalized field of contestation, which would be like a more agonistic view of Dewey. That's a whole set of variables for change that are not paid attention to by the practice turn, because the practice turn practitioners want to say that within practice itself are the seeds of change, right? Then there's another branch of critique of the practice turn that actually does appear in the International Practice volume in the conclusion by Bud Duval, which is the post-structuralist critique. And Janice Bellinger's chapter also speaks to this, which I think is another neglected area. Namely, that the post-structuralist insight is that identities are performed. And to the extent that we have the ability to perform identities differently, and not identically, there's always change. And I think this is right, but I'm not so sure that it's relevant in the sense that, like one example I give is, you know, if I tell you I'm buying a green car, everyone in the audience understands me. And simultaneously, no one in the audience has the same idea of what color green is than anyone else.
And this is...
You have difference there. You have difference there. Right? There's not an identical understanding of the color green. And that, you know, and my answer, my, I guess my question is like, so what? The fact is, this is a Wittgensteinian insight, right? And Wittgenstein, in his book On Certainty, which doesn't get as read as much as Philosophical Investigations of the Tractatus, but in On Certainty, Wittgenstein opens the book by saying, how do you know you don't have seven floors beneath your basement? Have you ever looked? You know, typically Wittgenstein style. It's an aphorism, right? He's pointing out that we're certain of many, many things without ever reflecting upon them. And this is the insight in the practice turn that I read. This is the insight in Verdun, for example, about doxa that's completely missing from the practice turn. The fact is that the doxa, the unsaid, unspoken, unattended, unreflected upon, anchors us in such a way that we don't even think about the conditions in which we're situated, right? Let alone think about them in a critical way. Now, okay, so all this about social theory, right? But none of this would matter. In a certain sense, this is all very interesting from a social theoretical point of view. But to me, what's as important is the fact that science, not social theory, seals the deal. In neurocognitive psychology, for the last 20 years, has demonstrated that all these social theorists, all these pessimistic social theorists, William James and his Principles of Psychology in 1895, who talk about habits making ruts in the brain, are absolutely right. But the pessimism of these social theorists, which was just, you know, observational, right? I mean, social theorists are not doing more than just thinking hard about the social reality they observe. All of that kind of inductive reasoning about how the world works is now verified and validated by hundreds and hundreds of experiments done by neurocognitive psychologists showing that the brain is divided between an automatic processing area and a deliberative one, and that the automatic one accounts for almost all of our daily behavior, that the reflective part of the brain is very rarely engaged in it for necessary cognitive reasons. And so consequently, this idea that habits are deep and ingrained and they reproduce the status quo is 100% true. And so again, the practice turn and constructivism in general hate psychology. Why? Because they think it smacks of methodological individualism and psychologism. But in fact, I mean, Verdun himself talks about the habitus being a perception of the world. I mean, Verdun was not dismissive of psychology as an account of how the habitus works and how doxa works. But IR constructivists are. I mean, very, very few IR constructivists credit cognitive and social psychology as a way of getting at why intersubjective structures work the way they do. And for my money, again, perhaps maybe because of my upbringing with Jervis and so forth, but for my money, social and cognitive psychology, and now neurocognitive psychology, give us the nano and micro foundations for understanding why intersubjective structures are so powerful as constraints upon change. And I've yet to see any rebuttal other than you shouldn't have to justify your social theory by validating it with science. But for my money, it's absolutely critical that we try to, you know, figure out whether or not the really, really, you know, brilliant intuitions of social theorists have been empirically validated or not. I've gone on too long.
No. I mean, obviously, if, you know, this were Patrick interviewing you, he'd be engaged in a very detailed argument with you on precisely the point of whether we need to go to individual psychology to validate insights derived.
It's not individual psychology. I'm sorry. I mean, that was my point, is that we're talking about universals of brain science. We're not talking about individual Did you sync with these here?
No. I think we mean the same thing, whether or not we would need an account of processes, mental processes.
Well, we don't need it. We don't need it. But I think that if you're able to demonstrate that there's neuroscience out there that validates some of the propositions of social theory and invalidates others, we probably should give more credit to those that are validated rather than those that are invalidated.
Well, I'm not, as I was going to say, Patrick would have that argument with you. That was actually just a segue. Because one thing that I wanted to push back on was, I think I agree with you completely about the liberalness of constructivism and the liberalness of subvariants, many subvariants of constructivism, including a lot of the ways in which the practice term is being cashed out within, if not a capital C constructivist framework, then a small c constructionist framework with international relations. But I'm not sure I agree that it's entirely centered on the change problematic, because if you go back to the cognate debate in sociology, right, which is the backlash to Parsonsian structural functionalism, in which a lot of the social theories, and Stacey Goddard and I have written on this, a lot of the social theories that got deployed by constructivists against structural realism were really out of deployments against Parsons, right? So there's a kind of very strong parallel there. A lot of the people who many of the people who were making these claims against Parsonsian structural functionalism were not doing so, you know, that it didn't account for change, you know, it had a conservative status quo bias. We're not doing so on behalf of liberal positions, right? Many of them were Marxists or other kinds of radicals, social democratic in their orientation rather than politically liberal. Certainly, if you look at the historical sociology movement that emerged as a sort of very similar kind of let's critique structural functionalism for being historically universalist and not particular, those people were very interested in the proposition of change, but they weren't necessarily liberal. And so I wonder if you have a kind of both the dynamics you're talking about, but you also have the fact that constructivism, particularly in the American context, grows into an ecological niche that had been occupied by sociological liberals, right? So if you go back to the 70s and you look at what we would now call or was called at the time liberal IR theory, that was kind of a hodgepodge of, you know, arguments about culture, norms, society.
Who do you have in mind there?
If you even go back and look at sort of, the stuff that that Cohen and I were doing in the 70s, right, prior to 77, right, Power and Independence, or even the early volumes of Power and Independence, right? If you go back and look at the world society paradigm, right, which is often held up in the early 70s, at least as an alternative to realism. You know, these are kind of, they're world polity theory. They're not world polity theory in the sociological sense, but, you know, these are theories about transnational actors are running around. There's liberal transformation, all that sort of stuff. That stuff was very eclectic in terms of whether it was rationalist or constructivist or sociological or whatever the labels we want to use. Such that by the late 80s, there's this, you have some pieces, I think, that Joe Nye writes where he kind of laments the turn towards, economistic, rational choice accounts of liberalism, and says, you know, there's this other dimension of liberalism, the kind of international law dimension of liberalism that's dropped out. And I think that what happened in American IR was that constructivism essentially came out of that trajectory, right? The international law trajectory, the old social norms liberalism. There are even elements of that in the early turn towards a rational choice liberalism. And so liberalism becomes sort of neoliberal institutionalism, and you have people who would have been liberals, right? Not everybody, but you have a significant amount of people who would have been liberals and thought of themselves as liberals had liberalism not been associated entirely with, you know, microeconomic approaches. And so those people pick up constructivism or get involved with constructivism to make liberal arguments about change, right, against the realists. And so I think that there's a dual dynamic going there. I don't think it's just about change. I also think it's about the way in which contemporary constructivism has evolved really did pick up the torch of liberalism and had a lot of people who would have been doing liberalism in that sense who came upon it.
Right. Well, I think it's also there's a North American need for agency.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very. I mean, you know, I mean, there's an anti-structuralist bias in the United States that doesn't want to rob individuals of their sovereign autonomy to produce outcomes, and I think that suffused constructivism very early. I mean, that's a very interesting kind of intellectual history of the origins of constructivism. I wonder if you put names on this. I mean, when I think of the forefathers of constructivism, I think of Ruggie, Walker, Kratochvíle, and Onuf.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think of any of them as particularly liberal.
Well, I think John,
in their approach.
I think John Ruggie is, right? I mean, if you think about so obviously you also have Richard Ashley. I mean, the emergence of constructivism
there's a critical impulse to constructivism early on, and this is another thing I think that's been robbed from constructivism by emphasizing change and agency. The critical constructivist insight about the need for deinstitutionalization of structures, right? Or the replacement of structures with other structures, as in Foucault. I mean, Foucault doesn't think you're ever going to escape from discourse. It's just going to be another dominating discourse. So this kind of rump pessimism that you're never going to get to that liberal nirvana. It's always going to be power politics between intersubjective structures being deployed by one powerful group or another powerful group. This isn't permitted. There has to be a trajectory towards some more just, fair, equitable world. And certainly, Lent's latest work on, he's a card-carrying teleologist now for this ideal outcome. So I think, certainly Ashley in particular, and Walker to a lesser degree, but also Fritz and probably not John as much, have been and are very, very distressed at the loss of the critical turn in constructivism and its almost utter conventionalization, liberalization, as I've typified it.
Well, regardless of the strands that got us here, I think we don't disagree at all. I've even written some small things making this point, and was involved briefly in this, realist constructivist movement, which I think for many ways was an attempt to recapture, for some people, the critical dimension, for other of us, whether it was cast in critical terms or not, the power dimension. And without a doubt, power analysis and the centrality of power, qua power, in constructivism has been, it's just not there. It's been completely marginalized. Power is an adjutant to accounts of how we bring about change for a better world, or has been kind of conventionalized out of things. So, we don't disagree. And it is interesting to me the extent to which this happens now in the practice term, precisely because if you go back to many of the sources of practice analysis, are primarily accounts of the way that power works in social and cultural settings. So, we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one thing that would be kind of interesting to close on, since it's been a topic of discussion recently, and we've just spent a tremendous amount of time talking about international relations theory in a sense that some of our younger listeners would say, oh, that's so 1990s, right? this is so Gen X. We're the millennials now, and we don't do that stuff. And certainly there's been a lot of concern about, whether positive or negative concern, a lot of attention to the idea that international relations theory is no longer what it once was, or is in other ways dying or ending. Patrick and I just discussed this last week, and I was wondering what your take on this question is, this debate about the end of IR theory.
I just think that I don't know whether I put a positive or negative gloss on this, but I think I have a positive gloss on what I consider to be the deconstruction of IR theory. I mean, I think that the isms are eroding, that people, obviously, I think, you know, a plurality of the discipline continues to be animated by liberalism, realism, and constructivism. And they continue to think of problems in those terms and to set in, and to look for places in the world or in history where they can go about refining and demonstrating and testing and then invalidating those competing claims. But I think the field is moving more toward, almost like bricolage, you know, that people are, younger scholars, hopefully encouraged by us, are willing to find their theories anywhere, and they're willing to pursue problem-driven, even topically-driven research questions, picking up whatever theoretical approaches they think is of any purchase upon the social reality they're trying to understand. And I think this is courageous in a way because, as we still know, when one reads, you know, letters of recommendation and so forth, people want to know, well, what school are you in? Like, you mentioned about your own work. I was going to mention about your own work, you know, in the sense that, when fortunately you're not applying for any jobs anymore. When you do apply for a job somewhere, right, they compel you to write this intellectual statement, this intellectual autobiography that lays out who you are. And what does that force you to do? It's a disciplinary structure that compels you to categorize your work in terms of, you know, what schools were you in, with whom are you debating, and so forth and so on. You can't just write, well, I was interested in this question, I'm interested in that question, then I went over here, and then I read this book, and that became interesting to me. They think you're a dilettante, right? So I think the fact that IR is, some might say, degenerating, IR theory is degenerating, I think is actually a positive sign in the sense that people don't feel as constrained by the three main isms out there.
So let's close maybe with you giving us a plug for your recent book.
Well, it started as a constructivist account of the Cold War. And after I got around 400, 500 pages into it, I realized it was going to be a three-volume constructivist account of the Cold War. So volume one is from 1945 to 58. And for those of you who looked at the 2002 book on social construction and international politics, no, I only did 1955 and 99. So now I'm kind of committed to doing basically an alternative account of the Cold War from a constructivist perspective, you know, based upon this this idea of using, you know, mass common sense or discourses of national identity at the mass level to account for Soviet relations of the world from 1945 to 1991, and hopefully written in a sufficiently accessible style that can become an alternative text for those thinking of teaching undergrads about the Cold War, so they do not just read, revisionists and post-revisionists and post-post-revisionists, but they can actually read a constructivist account of the Cold War as well. So it's based, as before, on both, reading of novels and films and so forth, but also archival work on Soviet decision-making on foreign policy.
All right. Well, thanks so much for talking to us today. And have a great trip to Singapore, if such a thing is possible. But I hope you really enjoy it when you get there. And it's I do owe you a happy birthday, right? Is that correct?
Yes. I've gotten older.
Well, happy birthday.
Thanks, Dan.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thus ends Duck of Minerva, podcast number 5, recorded on 15 August 2012.